Today we're reading from Canto 4, Chapter 25, The Characteristics of King Puranjana, text number 8. Ete tvam sampratikshante, smaranta vaishavam tava, samparechamayakutais, chindante utita manyava. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. All these animals are awaiting your death, so that they can avenge the injuries you have inflicted upon them. After you die, they will angrily pierce your body with iron horns. Shall we repeat? All these animals,
are awaiting your death,
so that they can avenge the injuries you have inflicted upon them. After you die, they will angrily pierce your body with iron horns. Purport. Narada Muni wanted to draw King Parchinabarhishat's attention to the excesses of killing animals in sacrifices. It is said in the Shastras that by killing animals in a sacrifice, one immediately promotes them to human birth. Similarly, by killing their enemies on a battlefield, the Kshatriyas who fight for a right cause are elevated to the heavenly planets after death. In Manu Sanghita, it is stated that it is necessary for a king to execute a murderer so that the murderer will not suffer for his criminal actions in his next life. On the basis of such understanding, Narada Muni warns the king that the animals killed in sacrifices by the king await him at his death in order to avenge themselves. Narada Muni is not contradicting himself here. Narada Muni wanted to convince the king that overindulgence in animal sacrifice is risky because as soon as there is small discrepancy in the execution of such a sacrifice, the slaughtered animal may not be promoted to a human form of life. Consequently, the person performing the sacrifice will be responsible for the death of the animal, just as much as a murderer is responsible for killing another man. When animals are killed in a slaughterhouse, 6 people connected with the killing are responsible for the murder. The person who gives permission for the killing, the person who kills, the person who helps, the person who purchases the meat, the person who cooks the flesh, and the person who eats it. All become entangled in the killing. Narada Muni wanted to draw the king's attention to this fact. Thus, animal killing is not encouraged even in sacrifice. Om agina timarandasya giranjana salakaya chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri garve panchakalpataryubhyascha kripa sindhubhyeva cha patitanam bhavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namah. So the translation again. All these animals are awaiting your death so that they can avenge the injuries you have inflicted upon them. After you die, they will angrily pierce your body with iron horns. So here, Narada Muni has come to convince the king, Parchinabarhishat, to stop his karmakanda activities. We find very early in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that people of small intelligence are attracted to these karmakanda activities, fruitive activities for promotion to the heavenly planets, because the results of these activities are temporary. They do not give lasting results. And he encourages Arjuna to transcend the modes of material nature, transcend dualities, and to come to understand. Krishna gives the analogy that in a village you'll have very small wells, and there'll be a different well for each purpose. One will be for drawing water, one will be for washing clothes, one will be for something else. But if you have a great reservoir of water, that takes care of the necessity for many small wells. So similarly, if you know the purpose behind the Vedas, then you don't have to worry about these really digressions. And what is the purpose behind the Vedas? Krishna himself says he is the compiler of the Vedas, he is the knower of the Vedas, and ultimately by all the Vedas he is to be known. Krishna is ultimately the purpose of the Vedas, to know him. But since people are in the modes of nature, the Vedas were originally compiled, and they deal mostly with the three modes of material nature for gradual progression to transcend those modes. We find earlier in the Bhagavatam, there's a related conversation related to this one that we're looking at now, that the compiler of the Bhagavatam, an incarnation, the literary incarnation of Krishna, Vedavyas, he had compiled the four Vedas, the Samaveda, the Rigveda, the Ajurveda, the Atharvaveda. It was a great accomplishment, a great body of work. And yet, he felt within himself despondent. He was not satisfied after doing this incredible service. And at that point, the same Narada Muni came to him, and they had a discussion in which Narada Muni asked Vyasadeva the cause of his despondence, and Vyasadeva said to Narada Muni that you are like the super soul within the heart of everyone, so you must know what is my difficulty. Although, in fact, Vedavyasa himself already knew, but for the pastime, it went on like this. And Narada Muni told him very clearly that actually in compiling all these Vedas, people would be misled into fruitive activities. As we see here, King Prachinabharishat is misled into these karma kanda activities, that they would miss the actual purpose of human life. And he said, Narada Muni said, that that literature which does not glorify the name, the fame, the qualities, the form, the pastime, the paraphernalia of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is likened unto a place of pilgrimage for crows. But on the other hand, that literature which does glorify the Lord, even if it's imperfectly composed, it's heard and sung and relished by people who are honest, by the devotees. So he encouraged, Narada Muni encouraged Vyasadeva to go back to his writing and say the actual purpose of all the previous writing, all the Vedas he had already contributed. And at that point, Vyasadeva gave us this beautiful Bhagavat Purana, Amala Purana, the spotless Purana, which is entirely concerned with the activities, the fame, the form, the qualities, the paraphernalia of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in a similar way, Narada Muni has come to King Prachinabharishat, and he's telling him, don't be involved with this Vedic activities, pious activities, fruitive activities, because there's a great risk. If it's done properly, King Prachinabharishat will be elevated to the heavenly planets, and the animals that are sacrificed will skip, say, usually it's a goat, so they'll skip all the interim species and come directly to a human species. So in that way, both will benefit. But there's a great risk. First of all, that's not such a great benefit for King Prachinabharishat, because from the heavenly planets, one falls down again to earth and starts again transmigration. So it's not such a wonderful accomplishment, and there are many distractions in the heavenly planets. Just like we see even on this planet, Hawaii is considered very close to heavenly planet because the atmosphere is so nice and the weather is good and the people tend to be very healthy. But Krishna consciousness has problems in Hawaii, there are many problems. So a heavenly planet can be a distraction as far as achieving the ultimate goal of life. But then on the other hand, if the sacrifice is done improperly, which there's a great risk that the mantras will be chanted improperly, then the animal will not be sacrificed in that it won't attain a human birth, but it'll be killed, as Prabhupada says here. It's just like murder, it's like a man murders another man. And then the king, instead of being elevated to the heavenly planets, he'll have to suffer for that sinful activity of killing an animal. So there's a risk, and Narada Muni is using this very, actually it's mystic power. He's allowing the king to see what will happen after his death, that these animals will be avenging the injuries that the king had inflicted upon them. So here we're finding the classic example of the spiritual master coming and imparting knowledge to the disciple. And why is it so important? Why is it vital? Because ignorance is the cause of all sin. And sin is the cause of all suffering. So if we want to get out of suffering, we have to stop sinning. If we want to stop sinning, we have to get out of ignorance. And to get out of ignorance, we need knowledge, which Narada Muni is giving here, which Srila Prabhupada is giving to us. So knowledge is essential for the human being. And how do we get that knowledge? We get it by shravanam, hearing. Srila Prabhupada expects that since we have this human form of life, we will be able to control the restlessness of our bodies and our minds and be able to sit and hear. Mondays when we go to see the video of Prabhupada speaking, we'll find that although he speaks with some intensity and some feeling, it's not a monotone, but he's not trying to entertain us. He expects that we have the intelligence to know that it's our responsibility. Since we have human intelligence, our responsibility is to use that human intelligence to understand our purpose, the real meaning of life. So simply by sitting patiently and hearing from a bona fide source, from the proper source, then we can acquire faith. Ado Shraddha, that's the beginning. Shraddha, faith, comes by hearing from the proper source, from the pure devotee. And then gradually, by this faithful hearing, then knowledge comes. But it's not the kind of knowledge that one ordinarily thinks of in knowledge in the material world. Later on in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13, Krishna describes 24 elements of knowledge. They're gross elements, they're subtle elements. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, then the mind, intelligence, and the aggregate, the unmanifest, anger, desire, hatred. These are all aspects of knowledge. But this is not the knowledge that Krishna is referring to when he talks of transcendental knowledge. It's one small aspect of complete knowledge. Beyond this knowledge, which is studied in schools and universities throughout the world as being actual knowledge, which it is not, there's also knowledge of the soul and knowledge of God. So there's the external energy, the internal energy, the marginal energy. There's the field of activities, the knower of the field, the proprietor of the field. There's the body and the soul and the friend of the soul. There are many ways to look at it, but the basic idea is that there is something beyond the 24 elements that we simply can perceive with our senses. And understanding that, the entire body of knowledge, is what Krishna considers knowledge, not what is taught in college, other colleges, not this college, but other colleges throughout the world. So this knowledge is unique, and it has a unique effect on one who attempts to understand it. Also in the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives a fascinating list of 20 items. And he says, these 20 items constitute knowledge, and anything else is ignorance. So he summarizes knowledge in 20 items. The first is humility. And Prabhupada says that this list of 20 items is like a staircase. Without humility, there is no question of attaining any higher step. There is no question of actual knowledge without humility, and progressively up through the steps. But humility means that I understand that I am an insignificant serving component in this vast universe of living entities, all of whom are serving. Humility means that I don't think that I am God's gift to mankind, but rather all living entities by their constitution are serving. Even take the beautiful trees here in Radhadesh. In the summer when they have leaves, each leaf takes in the carbon dioxide, right, and produces oxygen. What a glorious service the trees are serving. And you figure that they protect us from the sun. The trees create some shade, so when the sun is very hot in the summer, we can get some relief. And they're also aesthetically, they're beautiful. If it was just a desert, It would not be very pleasing to the eye. So the trees help create a beautiful atmosphere. And then when we feel cold, we can cut the trees down and burn them. They keep us warm. In this way, the trees, even the trees, are serving. So similarly, every living being, by constitution, is a servant. And we are also servants, each one of us. But we have the unique opportunity to understand the ultimate object of our service and how to serve and why to serve. That is our unique facility. The next item of knowledge Krishna mentions is pridelessness. That as soon as one becomes proud of anything that he or she has, any physical or mental ability, that is not a symptom of knowledge, that is a symptom of ignorance, because that is a gift from Krishna. It is not a product of anything we can acclaim as our own. It is Krishna's gift. So humility, pridelessness, then ahimsa, nonviolence. That knowing that every living entity is ultimately a spiritual soul and is going through its various process to become closer to Krishna, the devotee is nonviolent to all living entities. Does not want to see anyone hurt. And then tolerance, that so many things may hurt us. There would be so many dualities, pleasure and pain, happiness and distress, evil and goodness, honor and dishonor, fame and infamy. But Krishna expects us, if we're going to be knowledgeable, to tolerate these dualities. And then simplicity, that we're not meant to be cunning or not straightforward, but simple in our life and in our way of thinking. So after these five preliminary items of knowledge, the next one is accepting or approaching a bona fide spiritual master. And we see that in the case of certainly Arjuna, that he was very humble when he came to Krishna and said, "Please instruct me." He was prideless. He was simple. Right? He was tolerant. These are the preliminary qualifications. Then one accepts a spiritual master, and next, cleanliness. That one becomes clean in mind and body. Certainly in body is straightforward, but clean in mind, because once one approaches a spiritual master and accepts that person, it means that we're supposed to represent that person. It means we should have clean mind to do that. Jaya Shishi Radha Gopinath. When we were in India, Prabhupada would tell us that if we didn't act properly, it would reflect on him. The disciple is supposed to represent the spiritual master. So cleanliness is a vital aspect of that representation. So Krishna goes on explaining items of knowledge. Another one is to perceive the evil of birth, death, old age, and disease, to be detached from the material world, to be detached from home, not irresponsible, but not attached, detached from home, family, children, and so forth. And he goes on and he mentions that finally, unalloyed devotion to him. That is the most important item on his list of 20 items of knowledge. That once we have this, the other items will come. And if we lack this item, then the other items are of no particular value. But it's not even the final item. Also, we're supposed to engage in a philosophical search for the absolute truth. That we're never thinking, oh, now I have Krishna, but always I am looking, where is Krishna? How can I understand Krishna better? How can I serve him better? How can I help his servants to serve him? In this way, these are the items of knowledge. And unlike mundane knowledge, once one has this transcendental knowledge, it affects his entire consciousness. First of all, to attain this transcendental knowledge, we are obliged to have self-control. We cannot be eligible to attain transcendental knowledge without following the regulative principles of freedom, meaning avoiding intoxication, meat eating, illicit sex, gambling. This is the requirement for eligibility for getting transcendental knowledge, which also distinguishes it from material knowledge. Material knowledge, there's no such requirement, unlike this. But then once one tastes this transcendental knowledge, there's a result. One result is one becomes free from doubts. One becomes free of fear. For those of us who saw the pastime of Srila Prabhupada leaving this world, he was completely free of fear, the fear of death. So that is available to all people who take to transcendental knowledge. Also, Krishna says that for one who, he compares this material world to an ocean of miseries. Just like in this small little temple, we have some people who have back problems, some people who have migraines, some people who have tooth problems. It's an ocean of miseries. Practically every one of us, if we don't have problems now, we'll have problems soon enough. But this transcendental knowledge is like a boat. And when we get on this boat, we can cross this ocean of miseries. Transcendental knowledge is also compared to a fire, that it burns up the reactions of our previous sins, the fire of transcendental knowledge. It's called the most sublime knowledge, the purest knowledge. And moreover, not only can it free us of doubt and free us of fear and free us of miseries, but even more, transcendental knowledge can make us joyful. Susukam. Krishna says, this knowledge is the king of all education, the most secret of secrets. It's the purest knowledge. And because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it's the perfection of religion. It's everlasting and it's joyfully performed. Sukham means joyful, or sukham means happiness. And susukham, su means very, so very happy or joyful. So it's something we can personally experience. Prabhupada gives us the example that just like if you're very hungry and you're given a plate of nutritious, well-prepared prasadam, as you eat that prasadam, you feel nourished and satisfied. Your hunger is satiated. You don't need someone to come with a certificate saying, yes, now I'm full, now I'm satisfied. So similarly, taking to this transcendental knowledge, eventually we feel joyful. And it's not a joyfulness that's dependent on the weather. It's not a joyfulness that's dependent on what we have or what we don't have. It's not even dependent on how our relationships are going. It's an internal joy that survives despite these transitory things that affect us day by day and year by year. Susukam, kartam avyayam. So it's eternal and it's joyfully performed. And if we lack this knowledge, if we ignore this knowledge, then Krishna says, not only won't we taste this transcendental happiness, but we won't even be happy in this world. For the doubting soul, there is happiness neither in this world nor the next. So he's encouraging us to take it seriously and progress gradually with patience and enthusiasm and conviction. So, if there are any comments on this, we have a few minutes. Prabhuji? Well, you can't get knowledge of Krishna unless you are humble. It'll be You'll be blocked. There'll be an obstacle. So, I was personally present on two occasions during a lecture when Prabhupada mentioned this Guru Vandanam prayer that we sing every morning. It was once in New York City and once in Philadelphia. And he challenged us. He said, "You sing this prayer every day, but do you know the meaning?" So it's a very profound song. I think after that we started saying it in English. But one line in this song is Divya Gyan Ride Prakasito. So Divya is transcendental, right? Gyan is knowledge. Ride, it's in the heart. Prakasito means revealed. It's already there in the heart. But by doing these various processes to please Krishna, that knowledge will be revealed to us. Is that relevant? Also in this song that we sing, there's another line that says, avidya vinasayate, right? Same theme, that avidya is knowledge, avidya is ignorance. Vinasa is a very strong word, destroys. So the spiritual master is destroying ignorance with the light, the torchlight of knowledge. Just like in Sharanagati, when we first moved there, we didn't have an electrical system. We actually brought it with us from California, solar panels and inverter and batteries and wires and this. So at first, for the first month or so, it wasn't set up. So as the sun set, it got darker and darker inside the house until it was black. Couldn't see anything at all inside our own house. So we found that if we just lit one candle, then all of a sudden we could see everything. Not that clearly, but enough that we wouldn't bump into it. So just a little bit of light in the darkness makes all the difference in the world. Avidya vinasayate, destroying ignorance. Prabhu?
You mentioned this please, yes, serving, yes. Okay, I can understand how please, but they serve us, but what about animals? Oh, that's the old term.
Well, of course, there are a million. Oh, the question is trees. We can understand how trees serve us, but what about animals? How can we understand how animals serve us? So, of course, there are many, many different species of animals, and each one would have a unique way of contributing to the whole ecological scheme that we're a part of, that are necessary. But, for instance, in Sharanagati, we have horses, and the dung of the horse is very helpful for our gardens. It makes the soil very rich for compost. And of course, the horses help with transportation. And they're part of this whole ecological scheme. We will find that now they're finding that as one animal becomes extinct, it affects the whole, you know, because one animal is food for another, and you know, it's a whole system. So each one is there for a purpose. We may not know that purpose, but there is a purpose. And as the animals become harmed, and sometimes even extinct, we're discovering they actually had a very important purpose in Krishna's creation. Once we were walking in Mayapur towards the bank of the Ganges, and Prabhupada pointed to what looked like a useless weed, and he said that it also has a purpose. We simply don't know what the purpose is. So every living entity has a purpose, and it's our ignorance that we don't know yet. But when they're gone, we may suddenly find out, oh, that was the purpose, when it's extinct. Thank you very much for your attention. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.